The Life of Jesus by Brother Melba Purkis. Book 7, Chapter 3. Zacchaeus, make haste and come down. Jesus turned from the mountains of Judea toward Jerusalem. Apart from a few nights in adjacent Bethany, he would not leave the city again. The disciples watched him as he took the road toward the south. There was a kingly majesty in his bearing that checked their impulse to go beside him. They let him walk on ahead. A purposefulness about him amazed and frightened them. They dare not speak. Walking steadily behind the silent figure, sometimes losing sight of him on a bend in the road or over a shoulder of rocks, they left him to his thoughts. But they found him waiting for them in some quiet place, sheltered from the burning sun. And when they were settled and refreshed, he opened his heart to them, unfolding the complete picture of the events that were to transpire within a week in Jerusalem. When he'd first spoken to them of these things, he told them only that he must suffer many things and be killed, and rise again the third day. On the next occasion, he had added the terrible truth of his betrayal, but now he revealed the whole picture. Behold, you go up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man shall be delivered unto the chief priests and unto the scribes, and they shall condemn him to death, and shall deliver him to the Gentiles. And they shall mock him, and shall scourge him, and shall spit upon him, and shall kill him. On the third day he shall rise again. The disciples listened, but did not understand. Confused between their conception of the Messiah and this awful picture of suffering and death, they could not find a perspective. The changed trend in the teaching of Jesus and the growing atmosphere of impending crisis had had its effect upon them. In spite of all that he was telling them, they persisted in entertaining hopes of immediate glory. But surely the beloved John would understand. No, not even John. The journey continued in silence. They met, possibly by arrangement, a company of pilgrims from Galilee. There was a happy reunion as James and John saw their mother again. News of the resurrection of Lazarus and the nearness of the Passover had apparently persuaded Salome that the time for the manifestation of the Messiah was imminent. It seems possible that, like Mary, she'd lost her husband, Zebedee. And with the unselfishness of a true mother, all that she now desired was the best that her master could give for her sons. Her interest did not displease James and John. Their growing intimacy with Jesus during the past months had its less pleasing side. It had been revealed by their high-handed rebuke of the one who cast out devils in their master's name, and their imperious request that they should be allowed to call fire down from heaven upon the inhospitable Samaritans. Now the mother and her two sons sought to settle for all time the vexed question of who should be the greatest in the coming kingdom. Jesus had spoken only a few hours before of the Son of Man sitting on the throne of his glory, and of the exaltation of the apostles to 12 thrones, but this was not enough to satisfy them. The two disciples were hesitant to speak out. They had seen their master turn on Peter, and they had already suffered a stern rebuke themselves. They could not be sure now what he would say. But Salome, with less knowledge of his spirit and with warm love toward her sons, approached him, and worshipping made her request. Grant that these two my sons may sit one on thy right hand and the other on the left in thy kingdom. No time could have been less opportune for this request. James and John had watched Jesus earlier in the day with fear in their hearts as he started toward Jerusalem. They had listened as he spoke of his impending sufferings. And even if they could not understand the purport of what he said, they should surely have seen the preoccupation of their Lord, and been full of solicitude towards him as they pondered his words. Yet the petition, for all its pride, was wanting in neither faith nor loyalty. They had asked to share his glory. Did they realize that the glory lay in sacrifice? With loving patience, Jesus considered this joint request, and he turned not to the mother, but to the disciples. Ye know not what ye ask. His mind contemplated the path of darkness and suffering that lay immediately before him, the deep waters which would pass over his soul, the conflict, the desolation of spirit. The way to the side of the King of Glory was the way of a man of sorrows. Are ye able to drink of the cup that I shall drink of, and to be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with? They cannot truly know. They will be better able to answer when they have been through some of the experiences of the next few days. Then, realizing something of the fellowship of his sufferings, they may be able to answer, not in our strength, but with thine, O Lord. But now, encouraged rather than dejected by words which seem to offer them hope, their hearts prompt the answer, we are able. You shall, and it will indeed be the road to glory. But to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but it shall be given to them for whom it is prepared of my Father. It's hardly surprising that the other 10, having heard this conversation, were deeply upset. They were indignant with their brethren, not it is to be feared because they had ignored the feelings of their master, but because they had sought a privilege they themselves dearly wanted. Jesus called them to him and spoke to them of the true nature of apostleship. They must not seek exaltation for the purpose of domination. The principle upon which apostleship is based is not so. True greatness can only be found in humility and in serving one another. This is the only qualification for rulership. There is no other way. They must follow their Lord. He was taking that path. The Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give his life a ransom for many. As they journeyed southwards, more and more pilgrims joined them. They neared Jericho, and news of his coming went on before him. A few miles north of the Dead Sea and some 15 miles northeast of Jerusalem, Jericho was a beautiful town. Over 800 feet below sea level, it was always hot, but luxurious plants, palms and flowers grew in its stately gardens. Herod the Great had spent money there lavishly. He built its walls, flanked by 4 great towers and its amphitheatre. His son Archelaus had built its palace and laid out its rose gardens. Away across the salt waters of the Dead Sea, the hills of Moab made a purple background. It was a city of life and romance, colour and fragrance, a centre for both priest and tax gatherer, a busy market on the great highway from Egypt to Arabia and Damascus. The news spread that Jesus was on his way to Jerusalem for the Passover. Bethany was only 12 miles away. Everyone had heard of the raising of Lazarus and the decision of the Sanhedrin which followed. The Lord would have to pass through an avenue of eager, curious people. One of Jericho's richest citizens was anxious to see Jesus. Zacchaeus was the chief of the tax gatherers for that region. Was it merely curiosity which brought him to see this friend of publicans and sinners? It seems more likely that he was a rather lonely man in spite of his money. The powerful priestly element would keep him out of the social life of the city, and the common people despised and shunned him. Probably looking back on his life and the source of his wealth, he felt some sympathy with men's hostile attitude towards him. His conscience was at work. The more he heard of Jesus of Nazareth, and he had probably heard much, the more convinced he became that here was a man who would understand this estrangement of spirit and encourage these faint stirrings of contrition. But the road by which Jesus must come was crowded, and Zacchaeus was small of stature. He tried to push forward, but someone recognized him and the word went round quickly. There were dark scowls followed by angry cries, and he backed away. He heard the shouts which heralded the approach of Jesus. He must see him. Jesus was nearly level with him now, and the crowds were closing in behind. Something seemed to impel him. It had become imperative for him to see this rabbi. He broke into a run, keeping well ahead. A large sycamore tree spread its branches across the road, and he saw in it the answer. Without hesitation, but not without effort, he climbed it until astride one of its limbs he was able to peer between the leaves at the road below. He could see Jesus quite clearly now. Surrounded by his disciples, hemmed in by the seething crowds, now he was below him. With a sense of unreality, he heard his name. Zacchaeus, make haste and come down, for today I must abide in thy house. With a great joy in his heart, he scrambled back along the branch and down to the ground. He knew in his heart that a great change was about to come into his life. He, who had seen Nathanael under the fig tree, had seen Zacchaeus in the sycamore tree. If with all our heart we truly seek him, we shall surely find him, and be found of him. Christ can so easily be hidden by the crowds that press around him, the indifferent, the curious, the hostile, the patronising crowds. Our desire to see him and a sense of need must be great enough to lead us to climb into the sycamore tree. The urgent and imperative nature of Christ's words is full of meaning. He must make haste. Jesus was only passing through the city in a last journey. He must dine with him. It was the inevitable consummation for the sinner who had found the Saviour, and the Saviour who had found the sinner. What transpired during these short precious hours we do not know, but we know the result. Zacchaeus stood at the door as Jesus was about to leave him. "Behold, Lord," he vowed, "the half of my goods I give to the poor, and if I have taken anything from any man by false accusation, I restore him fourfold." Claims would soon be coming in from the people who stood listening to this promise, but Jesus was satisfied that he would make it good. The unceremonious scrambling up the tree was not the only humble thing Zacchaeus had done that day, and his Saviour left him with a parting blessing. "This day is salvation come to this house, for so much as he also is the son of Abraham. For the Son of Man is come to seek and to save that which was lost."